thanks for taking the time, and it's your last week, so I'm sure there's some feelings you've got about that.
I suppose so. My main feeling is, oh, can I get all my work done before I finish? I mean, that's my biggest concern.
And how do you do that when you have a couple hundred, 400 cases in front of you?
Well, I really only have two orders I have to get out because I sat on the trial, so, you know, I'm the one that has to do it. The other orders, Judge Selden can do easily.
And how much have you been working with Chris on prepping him for this job?
Actually, a fair amount, although he's doing a lot on his own. So we've met, I think, three times. We've gone over the calendar. We've gone over how I set up my Word so that he can find my old orders and he can copy what he can copy. I know he's bought two books to help him with both criminal and divorce. So, I mean, he's really being diligent, much more so, I hate to admit, than I was when I started.
Yeah, but you had some more background, I think, than he did as far as working in the U.S. Attorney's Office, right, and some of your prosecutor work?
You know, I certainly had more criminal experience than he has, but he's had more civil experience than I have. So, and he's had dependency and neglect experience, which I had none. So, you know, we all start with an emphasis, and his is more juvenile, dependency and neglect, and civil, whereas mine was more criminal than not.
And what is the majority of your cases? Is it criminal or is it civil?
Oh, the majority are definitely civil if you include the domestics, by far. I mean, criminal is probably 1/10 of the work, except for when you have a lot of trials. So those vary over time. But, you know, really the thing that takes up the most time are the domestics and the civil.
And how many cases do you have that are active right now in this court? I mean, is it like, isn't it in the hundreds?
Oh, it's definitely into the hundreds. I really have never counted them. And I'm passing on to him my caseload out of Garfield and as well as the caseload out of Rio Blanco. So we have cases all over.
That brings me to a question of what do you see as one of the biggest challenges that Judge Selden will have going into this?
I really hadn't thought that he has that many. I've really whittled down my caseload as far as divorces and criminals. So really, the only thing he has to face right away are civil, and he knows that. So I don't think that'll be a problem. You know, and then he'll just have to get used to sitting at the bench. I think it's just a different experience because you're so used to being the attorney, and it's a bit odd. But, I mean, if you know him, he's calm, he's smart. I think he has that judicial temperament. I can't imagine he would ever lose his temper. So I really don't see him having that great a challenge other than just getting used to the way our computer works, kind of those practical things.
But don't you have to kind of get yourself up to speed on the cases? And, you know, those are some thick files. Do you have to read them all and go through it all?
Yes, and you have to learn a lot of new law. I always give this example. You may not want to use this, but my first week on the job, I had a juvenile female ask me for permission to have an abortion without telling her parents. And in Colorado, the judge makes that decision. So you have to look up the law. What is the law on that? What do the rules say? What are the standards? What do you do? I mean, I was flabbergasted that I was given that power. But there's always... I just learned how you declare someone dead when there's no body. You know, there's these peculiar things, and you have to look them up because there's no answer until you look at the law.
What did you decide?
Well, my recollection is that I granted her the right to have it without telling her parents. The standards in substance are that there's probable cause to believe she's mature enough to make the decision, and probable cause to believe that she understands the potential ramifications. So, I mean, we all have friends who have had abortions, and it can have a tremendous psychological effect on a person. So you want to make sure she knows about resources to address that. And this one in particular had talked to a cousin who had gone through it, and she was aware of how you can get depressed and what to do, and she had someone to talk to anyhow that knew what she was going through. You know, these are very, very difficult decisions.
What has been your most difficult decision since you've been sitting on the bench?
Probably the most unpleasant one was terminating parental rights. In fact, the one time I had to do it, or the two times I had to do it, it was, you know, the evidence was pretty overwhelming. So it wasn't a hard decision, but it was a depressing decision, I guess is the right word. It's something when you said hard decision, that's what I thought of. Those dependency and neglect cases are very, very difficult.
Right, just from the nature of the case.
Exactly. I mean, you never want, no matter what, no matter how poor the parent is, usually the child loves the parent because that's all they've ever known. So you're, you know, even though in the long run it's the right decision, you know that there's harm to the child no matter what you do. Right. And that's a difficult thing.
How about from a civil standpoint? I know that you've had some pretty complicated cases and, you know, controversial ones. Like you've taken some time on some of them. What goes into that when you're deliberating on something that's complicated and contentious?
Most of the time it's the facts. You really have to review the, if not the transcript, your notes carefully to figure out the facts, because it all comes in so fast. You really, you know, you're kind of in a blur for a while. Once you have the facts down, usually the law is not that hard, and it's not that hard to decide. Civil law is, there's a lot of it. I wouldn't say it's complex. I would say there's a lot of it, so you have to really research the law. But once you have the facts down, it's not that hard.
How many decisions have been reversed that you've made, both from a civil and criminal?
Well, somebody reported on a reversal just this week. That was on a restitution case in a criminal matter. I remember there was another big criminal matter I got reversed on, too. One was discovery and one was a search. I think, really, I've been fairly, I have not been reversed that much, in my view. On the other hand, the last week I was here, I got reversed, so you never know.
was that from the Supreme Court, Colorado Supreme Court reversed it? No?
No, that was Court of Appeals.
Okay, what case was that?
That was the Antler restitution. I haven't read it that carefully. My recollection of the facts was that the defendant had taken both raw and finished materials, had converted the raw materials into a finished product using the, you know, the pattern of the victim, and then sold it. When, the little I saw in the paper, it sounded like it was, they had a different idea of the facts. So I haven't read it yet. Right. When it comes back, it's going to be Judge Selden's issue to deal with.
There's been decisions that you've made, like regarding the AACP, that land use issues with the Aspen Area Community Plan, and how that's, and then that's been taken up to the Court of Appeals. Do you feel like the Court of Appeals, that's a panel of three, understands enough about what Aspen's unique community issues are to make decisions like that? And when it comes to land use lawsuits that are against the city?
Yes, I do. Although I'll qualify that, obviously the Court of Appeals, just like me, we're limited to what's presented to us. So usually I am presented with the whole AACP, so I have a good understanding of the whole, that if I have it, then the Court of Appeals does. So I do think they, you know, my feeling is when I've been reversed, generally speaking, I agree. I remember one case where I didn't, but that was really a difference of opinion more than anything else.
Although you have a little bit more intimate knowledge about it, since it's discussion among the community and you are a community member, you don't let that influence you at all.
I certainly try not to let that influence me. I mean, I'm supposed to be limited to the evidence that's presented, and it's one of the things I'm looking forward to in retirement. While a judge, I avoid everything. I mean, I'll read the paper, but I won't go to meetings. I try to avoid political discussions about what's coming up because, you know, I want to be limited to what's presented.
So you kind of live in a little bubble to a certain extent.
Definitely. It's one of the things, well, when I became a judge, I quit Rotary. I quit a lot of the organizations that I belong to because it creates conflicts. And it's one of the things I'm looking forward to is being a bit freer.
Right. What are your plans for retirement? I know you said the first thing you're doing is buying a radio.
Yes, I am going to buy a radio because I miss listening to NPR. So I'm hoping to have a radio in my kitchen. I can listen to NPR for an hour before my husband gets up because he doesn't get up till 8. And that'll start my day well. But I'm going to Peru November 11th, and my husband worked for the ski company for 48 years, so we have lifetime passes, so I'll be skiing a lot this winter, and then summering in the East, at least while my mother's alive.
Let's talk about what led to your decision to retire now, and were you planning on retiring this quickly?
Actually, I planned to work at least till I was 66, but my father died last year, my mother's getting older. Everyone in my family except for me has retired, even my younger sister. So I think that a lot of that prompted me to do it a little quicker. I'm 65. I have my Medicare card. So I turned 65 yesterday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
This is a good week for you.
It's a big week. And, you know, we had our retirement party within the courthouse today for the clerks, and we had it here in the office so it would be quick so I can try to get some of this work done because I really, you know, I have two opinions that absolutely have to get out.
So what has your week looked like? I mean, you're packing up and you're looking at these two cases and trying to get those shored up, and that's anything else?
Yes, I'm going to go through my Word documents and try to make them a little more understandable for Judge Selden. When I started, I was given an empty computer. I had nothing, and, you know, it really helps if you have a lot of sample orders, because some things are just fairly routine.
Do you remember your first day on the bench and how that felt?
I didn't even have a computer, so it was a little like, what do I do here? So I just kind of read materials, and at that point, we still had a lot of paper cases, so I was able to look at files and that sort of thing.
What was your first day in the actual courtroom where you had to deal? Was it a docket day or?
Yeah, a criminal docket day, which of course I was familiar with it. And it was down Valley in Garfield, so I knew what I was doing on that.
What decision do you think has most impacted this community?
Well, I hate to think of things that didn't work out very well, but certainly my opinion on the Wienerstube that was appealed, and then we all know what happened after that.
And that was related to the AACP?
It wasn't, yes, but there were other aspects of it, too, because there was a lot of planning, zoning code in there. There was a lot of stuff. It wasn't just one issue, I don't think. So that was a fairly complicated case, and it was one of my first ones. It was an early one for me.
And that was the case in which the landowner, the developers, sued the city of Aspen for denying their mixed-use project where the Wienerstube was, and now we have the art museum and the building next door?
I affirmed what the city did. So I took this, I affirmed the city's denial. They then went up on appeal. The appeal was never addressed because the parties settled. Well, you know, I never really understood what happened after that. It was out of my hands and I had no way to know. I don't go to the meetings. I think the other case, which is still on appeal, is the Cora case. That's, to me, quite interesting. And I'm sure my criminal background is that if there is a confidential informant whose testimony is not needed and just has nothing to do with the case, there's no reason to disclose that identity of the confidential informant. And I know that certainly influenced me some in interpreting the statute of Cora, but I did get reversed on appeal. The county is appealing into the Supreme Court. I don't even know if they've granted cert, so I think it's still in process. But that's a very interesting issue.
Yeah, this is the case where there's a woman up on Red Mountain who wants to know the identity of her neighbor who complained about some construction work that she was doing on her house. And the issue is it could be precedent setting from a county standpoint.
The inspector for the county, but he went up and stood on the road and could see everything. So he knew there was no permit. He could see that there was major construction going on. What's the purpose of disclosing the informant at that point? And as I said, there are statutes that bear on it that aren't necessarily totally clear. And I'm sure my background coming from the criminal side is, why create a fight when there's no need to create a fight? The female did testify and said she wanted to know so she could, you know, make up with the neighbor and resolve it with the neighbor, but the neighbor has no power to issue a permit, and the permit had to be issued, and she got the permit. So it all came out well, but it's, you know, it's a very interesting issue. I will say I've told other people this of the case. My mother said, of course she has a right to know. A friend of mine in the Valley, of course she has the right to know. So, you know, this is a very, very interesting issue.
What about trials? You've had a few high-profile trials. Peter Nardi, the Pfister case. I know that that had to have been one for you since being a longtime community member, knowing that family, background of skiing, Buttermilk. Give me a little bit of reflection on that.
Well, certainly the Pfister murder trial wasn't a trial. It resolved. That was challenging just because it's kind of nonstop. But again, I had done a murder case twice before as a judge. I thought both sides were very, very well represented, and that helps tremendously. Granted, there were many, many, many motions, but that's the defense job. So, you know, I actually thought that came out well. There were some interesting issues coming up, but it was, you know, it was handled very well on both sides. I think that's what I got out of it the most is, you know, people really worked hard. The sheriff's office, the prosecutor, and all the defense attorneys, because there were three sets of defense attorneys. I mean, they all had to work and still kind of get along to some extent, and they did an excellent job.
Some people would say they're not very happy with the outcome of that, and there should have been a trial. Prosecution should not have accepted that confession. Do you think there was enough evidence for them to go? Can you talk about that?
Well, I really can't because I don't know the evidence. The evidence presented to me was, you know, fairly limited. We had not had a preliminary hearing, so I didn't even get anything other than really what has now been produced to the papers and to the public. But, you know, my position is you don't second guess the prosecution and the defense, because here you have two sides agreeing that this is an appropriate resolution. So, given the age of Mr. Styler, and given what I assume both the defense and the prosecution knew about the evidence, because I don't know it, these were very competent prosecutors and defense attorneys. I think it was a very good resolution. I think the family and the community should be satisfied with that resolution.
We'd probably still be dealing with it now.
I'm sure we would be. I mean, my murder trial that I tried in 2010 and 11 is still on appeal. It hasn't even been ruled on by the Court of Appeals.
Is that the one that was tried in Rio Blanco?
Tried first in Rio Blanco and then in Garfield because I transferred venue because it was going to be very difficult to get a second jury in Rio Blanco.
What was that case?
Father murdered his son. And the plea was not guilty by reason of insanity.
What are you going to miss the most, and what are you going to miss the least?
Well, the most, really working, watching trials, watching arguments, reading papers, because the law is very interesting. I really enjoy dealing with the issues. And the attorneys, almost, you know, 99% are very good, and they do their best, and I'm very pleased with their work. So that gives me the stuff I need to make decisions. One of the things I'll miss the least is getting up at 5:30 and running in the morning, because that's when I do my exercise, and it's dark now. In the summer, it's great, but now it's like, oh. So now it's about 7, get up, run, come home, listen to the radio, have breakfast.
What's the workload of this job? I know that I've been waiting for arrest affidavits at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night. Tell me how much you're working and how much will the incoming judge handle?
Well, my husband would say, don't put yourself down, but I think I'm somewhat slower in writing than maybe others. So I generally work I leave the house at 7. I'm here by 7:30. I work until 7. I get the 7 o'clock bus Monday through Friday. And then Saturdays, I usually work 4 to 5 hours in the afternoon. I work Sundays when my husband's gone all summer, but I do not work Sundays during the winter when he's home. I go skiing.
Right. That's when we see you at Bonnie's.
Exactly. And you see me hiking on Saturday morning.
Right. What is your most satisfying decision on a case where you've walked away and said, yeah, that was the right thing? I'm sure that's how you feel on all of your decisions, I would hope.
I know immediately what my most satisfactory decision was, and it was in a domestic case, so I can't talk about it. So there was that. You know, that one was so much, you know, so satisfying, because I think I nailed it on the head, you know, which is hard to do on a very hotly contested domestic case.
Can you speak in generalities or not? No?
No, it's too unique. I can't think of a civil case where I thought I nailed it, you know, unless it was really easy. And, you know, there are some cases like foreclosures where pretty much routinely the debtor's going to lose. You nail it, but there's no satisfaction because there's no real issue.
You handle domestic, divorce, criminal, civil, land use, everything, right?
Probate, conservatorships, guardianships. You name it. That's what is good about this job. You learn constantly. The tougher part is because it covers such a wide area of law, it's everything, you're never an expert on anything, or at least that's the way I feel.
Over the course of your career, which maybe you can just give our listeners a brief rundown of what it is, reflect on this job compared to the other ones. When you were a deputy DA and when you were in the with the big boys in Jersey.
Well, it's interesting. One of my favorite jobs was being the county court deputy in front of Judge Ely. She's a great judge to appear in front of her. I loved working with her. And also, I got to talk to people rather than just lawyers. And that taught me a lot because you're dealing with real people. So that was a good job. I felt good about what I did. It was manageable. And it was very personal. In the U.S. Attorney's Office, you never deal with the defendants ever. You never get to talk to them. You talk to their lawyers. And for the most part, these are people that intend to commit crimes. In Aspen, most of our people, there's no intent to commit a crime. They're usually alcoholics, drug addicts. They do something stupid. They get mad at their wife or their husband, and they do something stupid. It's generally just not serious criminal activity, whereas, you know, in New Jersey, for example, if we were going to do a cocaine case, we wouldn't take it unless it was 10 kilos. You know, it's a whole different, you know, scene. So it's just vastly different. That was fascinating work. I worked with great people. I mean, I've been very privileged given the people I've been able to work with over my career.
So you were a prosecutor in that office, right? And did you have organized crime that you were dealing with?
To some cases, you know, that's kind of the sexy part of New Jersey is the organized crime. But in reality, I did more fraud work. I was in charge of all the tax cases for the United States in New Jersey for criminal, and I did a lot of fraud cases, mostly securities fraud.
And was that the beginning of your career?
No, I started as a clerk for a judge in the Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, so that's the Federal Circuit. It's a great job. Again, I was with great people. It was a wonderful experience.
And then you went to the prosecutor's office, and then you worked for a private firm for a little while. How'd you get here?
I went to CU, so I graduated CU in 72, and I just decided I was sick of New Jersey, and I'd come out here. It was that simple. I just moved. I had no job. I just arrived.
And what do you think now that you're retired as a district court judge here, where you, you know, you're a ski bum, sounds like?
I feel very lucky. I've had, my father always said, smarts is one thing, hard work is more important, and more important than that is luck. And I've had a lot of luck. It just feels like I've lucked out. And I mean, I left New Jersey and came here really knowing no one. I got a good job in Denver, ended up marrying a guy who lived in Aspen. I mean, who wouldn't want to live in Aspen? Came to Aspen, landed a job with the DA's office, and then became a judge. To me, it's a dream career.
Have you ever been fired?
Yes. Although I resigned first, but when Colleen Truden was in the DA's office, I resigned, and the next day she came up and fired me. Colleen ended up doing, I think, 11. I mean, it was huge. That was a whole different ballgame.
Right.
I mean, it's true in the U.S. Attorney's office. When the U.S. Attorney changes, the chiefs change. But the regular people that do all the hard work, they're not affected. And that's usually true in the DA's office, too.
Do you think that there's been a lot of changes how this courthouse operates? And
well, changes may not be the right word. I moved here in 2002. The judges, there are two more. That's the big difference. When I came here, there were three. Then I was added as a fourth, and now Judge Neely is the fifth. I mean, it's a much busier district, and a lot of that busyness is located here. When DeVilbiss was here, he handled the whole docket in Pitkin, and that just is not possible now.
Right.
Judge Boyd tried, and, you know, it just was not possible, and I have not even tried. I do all the domestics, but the civil is split. I think I get two-thirds, and then the other third is split between the four judges down Valley.
How much has the caseload increased since you became a judge, percentage-wise? I know it's pretty high.
It's very high, which justified appointing new judges.
What can you attribute that to?
Increase in litigation. A lot of it, and we didn't really count it very heavily, were the foreclosures in 2008 through 10. Those were not given the same weight as other cases, but there's definitely an increase in litigation.
So we live in a more litigious society. Can you think back on your most memorable experience in this courthouse?
Well, it popped right into my head. It was the night Joe DeSalvo called me and said, I think we have a murder on our hands. Come to the courthouse. And I think I came in around midnight, and I was here most of the night. But I will say I was not here anywhere near as long as the deputies. I mean, they were working 20-hour days at least. So it was a lot of, and it was tough work.
That's a pretty shocking phone call to get, I would imagine.
Yes. I mean, we've had others. We've had, especially in Pitkin, murder-suicides, which are unfortunate, but doesn't leave a lot for the judge or anyone else to do.
Well, on a lighter note, was there any memorable, funny incident? I mean, other than, like, somebody running out of the courtroom and flying down the stairs and running toward Clark's.
Was that? That was Judge Boyd's,
I think. I think it was.
Luckily. Because I got the case after that happened. Recently, we had that motorcycle or motorbike that someone tried to steal, two guys, and they were so drunk they couldn't see the chain going through the tire to hold the bike in place. You know, you just kind of shake your head.
Anybody who's familiar with the people in this building, I think they would refer to you as a very compassionate judge, as well as Judge Ely. And I think they're going to miss the female presence on the bench. Have you talked to anybody about that or had that notion go through your head?
You know, I agree. Judge Ely and I both are at least empathetic with, in particular, people who are in a bind, whether it's domestic case, divorce, or DNN, or criminal. But I think I think certainly Judge Boyd was just as compassionate, and I have no doubt Judge Selden will be also. I really think that's kind of the Pitkin way, and you're kind of taught that. I remember in the DA's office, we had some young man come in, and he was gangbusters to put everybody in jail. But he learned the Pitkin way. You just can't get along if you don't.
Which is why, if you're a criminal, you want to get arrested in Pitkin County.
Actually, it does present a problem at times because you can see the defendants who are in jail don't want to go to DOC, and they do whatever they can to extend their time in the Pitkin County Jail. But that being said, I said to a young woman the other day, you know, you're lucky you landed in Pitkin. We have a lot of services, and Mine Springs is available. Judge Ely has done a great job in getting Mine Springs to work with our pretrial people. It really, both on the alcohol level, the drug level, and the mental health level, I mean, we're really unique. Don Bird's done a great job, and we can M1 someone out of the jail and get them back, and we don't have to, you know, make it permanent. They'll actually let him come back into the jail. That saves us a lot. It really, we have some phenomenal people working on that, and I think Don Bird and Judge Ely are two that really are responsible for the change. And I will say Roger Adams comes to court every day now, and he's been great. You know, I think a lot of that is pro bono time. I don't think he gets paid for that.
He's affiliated with Mine Springs, yes. And he's my predecessor.
I knew he was on the radio at some point, but he is affiliated with Mine Springs, but I don't think they pay him to come to court to report to us, this is how this person's doing, that person's doing. And it really is helpful because the people who get the treatment are going to get a better deal, community's going to be safer, and this person is going to start contributing rather than being a burden.
Anything else you want to tell the people in this community and the people who have come before you?
I've learned from almost everyone who's come before me. In particular, I've learned from the participants in the drug court. They're amazing, amazing people. I love living here. Even this morning, walking to work, all I can think of is I can't believe I live here. So it's a great place. I look forward to being a regular citizen.
What organization are you going to join first? You going back to Rotary or?
I'm
going to
hold off a bit until I spend a summer in the East to figure out how things work. I'd like to do English in Action, and I'll work with Alpine Legal Services.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.